today, and welcome to our first episode in English of Small Talk, which is Laugh Talk. And today with me are Omri Baum, Professor of Philosophy at the New School in New York, and Michael Sfard, Israeli human rights lawyer. Nothing more appropriate than that. So welcome, and thank you for joining me.
Great being here. Thank you, Karen.
What our English listeners don't know is that we've already met before on the Israeli Hebrew version of this podcast. And this podcast was born maybe to voice the sounds of left that are very scarce now in Israel. When I first started the podcast, I was thinking, well, we need maybe a new discourse, a new way to look at the reality. And we have to look inside before we look outside and see how to do that. And then it got me thinking, I'm not sure that when we say left in the Israeli politics, we really mean what we say, or it reflects the values that we think of when we say left. How is that for a start?
I cannot agree more. I think when Israelis say left, they mean one thing and a very narrow thing. And I think that when in political philosophy or even in the public discourse in most intellectual circles, what is ascribed to the left is something much more whole. And so we can see the Israeli, what is considered to be the Israeli left, we can see many things that otherwise would not, in any other context, would not be considered left. It can be ideologies that are completely on the right-wing scale of approaches to economy, for example. We can see very nationalistic positions in the Israeli left, because when Israelis say left, they tend to think only of the question of what is one's position towards the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And those who are in favor of annexation of the territories occupied in 1967, those who are in favor of the settlement enterprise in the West Bank are considered to be right-wingers. And those who are in favor of a two-state solution and a withdrawal from the West Bank, for whatever reason, whether it's because they advance human rights for all, or because they think this is what is good for the Jewish state, they both are considered to be left. So yes, the name of your podcast is a bit misleading.
It's misleading because it's big talk and not small talk, or because it's not really left talk. Well, I also could not agree more. Obviously, I think that what gets to be called in Israel left is often just not left by no standard, that we will call it. So not by the standard of what I guess we would like to call left within Israel, and also not by the standard of political philosophy, say a Marxist philosophy, or however you want to frame the picture. But I also want to present this from the other side a little bit. What I think we, and in a moment we'll see whether I'm right to say we, but I allow myself to say it. What we would like to call left in Israel, the so to speak real left, not the center left, actually, by those standards, does not even need to be left. It can be center, it can be right. Proper radical left by Israeli standards could even be in the center or the right. We're really, I think, just speaking about establishing a certain standard of, say, citizenship. Do people on the center and the right in Europe say CDU voters in Germany? I used to say decent Republicans, but I don't know who they are anymore. Let's say CDU voters in Germany. Do they not believe that the state ought to belong to all of its citizens? Do they not believe that basic citizenship is the main principle that has to guide any politics, regardless of religion, gender, and race? Of course they do, and of course they consider it basic to their concept of politics. And I think that's fundamental, actually, when we need to understand the situation in Israel. When we speak about changing the language, I think it's crucial to be able to say what we, allegedly radical leftists, by Israeli standards, want to establish is actually something that would be completely consensus in the center and the right in European countries. That's an important point to be making, I think.
Because this discourse is a civil discourse that maybe is lacking in Israel. And maybe when we say, I was about to say, or to focus on how we maintain something like the left, but basically maintain something that is not left. So we maintain some sort of a lie, which is not in accordance, not to the truth and not to reality. But actually, if we look, you know, further than that, basically, while speaking of Israel as a democracy, which is something very popular, we do the same thing, because basically we're not really talking about democracy, and it's about stretching the terms many times in Israel when we talk about democracy and we talk about basic rights.
Yeah, so again, I'll be just repeating myself, so I should have let Michael speak. I think it's maybe it's going to be politically savvy if we are to try to, quote-unquote, reinvent a certain left talk, precisely to insist that this is not what we're doing. We're trying to fight for democracy in Israel, and this is actually not a position of the left. It can reach a broader consensus maybe within Israel, even though that's probably too optimistic. It doesn't even have enough backing in the left. But maybe if we are to insist on truth as part of what we're doing, as maybe the only chance that we have, then we can start by saying it's not about being on the left. It's just about the basic principles of democracy, not leftist politics. Let's talk about that. That would be an interesting move. By the way, people, you know, historically, if you think about someone like Hannah Arendt, you mentioned that I'm coming from the new school, you know, that's, we like to call her Santa Arenta de la Scuola Nuova. Everything she says is true, right? She was not a leftist. She is remembered today as a leftist, among other things, because of her criticism of Israel and Zionism. That's not a leftist. She is one way or another also coming. She's not a Heideggerian either, but she's coming from a certain spectrum between Kant and Heidegger. Whatever that is, it's not, she's not Adorno and Horkheimer, this other Marxist tradition. She's just not a leftist. And that's, it's important to see.
Michael? I think the question of importance of the concepts and the meter that they present to us is because it makes things easier to explain who's against who and where are you situated on that spectrum. And when the Israeli society is completely distorting the way these concepts are being used in other places, it is done for a reason. It's not just a chance or a mistake, a historical mistake that Israel calls itself a democracy. Not just a democracy, mind you, the only democracy in the Middle East, right? And by the way, we have not invented this. There was another power in the past that called itself the only democracy in its area, and that's South Africa. South Africa called itself the apartheid South Africa, the only democracy in Africa. So it's important, while I agree that we can, you know, for the sake of our struggle, for the sake of advancing our values, we don't have to anchor ourselves in a specific term, but we do need to understand why these terms are used and abused. And the terms are used and abused for the sake of legitimacy. There is something about the, and look, the PR, I mean, I, I stopped calling Israel that I was born in Israel. I was raised in Israel. I got the Israeli indoctrination, and I became a, you know, a poster boy of an Israeli young man who was brought up in Israel, calling his homeland a democracy, wanting to fix what is needed to fix in that democracy to make it perfect. Now, I stopped calling Israel democracy several years ago for reasons we can later maybe discuss. And I don't think Israel is a democracy. But now that I stopped using that term in relation to Israel, I understand how huge is the PR success of using that term for the state of Israel. So while I agree with Omri that we don't need to anchor ourselves in these terms, it is important, the fight to fix the distorted vision of what these terms are has value. And when we talk about left, for example, of course, when we talk about democracy, it's important to understand what democracy is. And it's important that people would not think that democracy is all about elections, right? And majority and things like that. And that it is not about, and that ethnocracy cannot be democracy. But when we speak about left, for example, it is important to say that the left aspires to break up power structures. That left cannot be really left if it only fixes one wrong in the power structure and completely ignores other wrongs. And that eventually breaking up the problematic power structures is all in the service of bringing human rights and bringing dignity, freedom, and liberty and equality to all people. So I think we don't have to say that we are left in order to fight for this, but we have to correct those who misuse the term.
Yeah, I think we agree. Look, I think since it seems to me that we're both on the left, I don't have a problem saying that I'm on the left because I am on the left. I only want to, I mean, this is agreeing with Michael, in order to make the claim that Israel is not a democracy, that the change that needs to be taking place is in something deeper than taking the country to a certain leftist position. The problem in Israel is currently not that it's on the left, that it's not on the left. The problem is that it's not a democracy. And and I think that in order to make that point, it's very useful to say that I think the main struggle is not for leftist principles, but rather to establishing a democracy. I agree. Since I am on the left, I tend to agree with Michael that the way to do this is in a coherent language that breaks power structures that are on the right and that serve the nation state in a very certain way and need to be overcome by leftist politics. That said, and I think this is actually interesting now, even looking forward, I want to believe about our conversation. It's interesting. One of the things that I think, I know Michael and I probably agree, probably also Karen, if we want to start thinking leftist or democratic thinking in Israel as binational, then it's not obviously going to be leftist binational. For example, Ayman Odeh is a leftist. But Ahmad Tibi isn't, as far as I can tell. And I would run and do politics with Ahmad Tibi, not being a Taharan, not being a purist that I am. I would do politics with someone like Ahmad Tibi anytime, really. Well, actually, that's precisely the thing that we'll have to think about. Maybe not anytime if he's going to adopt or to push the country in ways that are not part of the coherent language that's on the left that I'd like to develop. However, by and large, the main idea of equal citizenship that someone like Tibi would like to promote, I would go hand in hand with. And that's an expression of me not being on a left Zionist position, but rather someone precisely who says, the main issue here is not leftist politics, but rather democracy. And I would do that with whomever, even if they're not on the left. The thought that you need to be on the left in some term, in some sense, and this is interesting, the thought that you need to be on the left in some sense in order to promote democratic politics is in that sense already a part of the conversation between the Jews, because obviously many Palestinians who are citizens who are, and those who are not, who would be able to promote with us a binational alternative in Israel, we can talk about that in a moment, may not be on the left at all. And that's an interesting question to be asking. Are we going to collaborate with that? How? What's the idea behind that?
And who are the victims of a model, whether it's binational one state or a federation or whatever, if it's not strictly following real left agenda?
Absolutely. I want to completely agree, Michael, but I want here, and this will it could emerge as a difference between us about how leftist we are on that. But maybe not. But for me, it's an open question. I'm not sure about the answer. I agree that there will be victims of that. The interesting question will be, to me, will those victims as citizens be the victims or the people who, pay a certain price? If we will manage to produce a certain democratic alternative, will their basic rights be defended in a way that now this will defending their rights, having that fight, and I will be fighting it with them, will be something that takes place as part of the democratic game and can be resolved in those issues? Or rather, we want to say, and that will take us further left, to say, no, the only thing that will achieve justice will be a certain struggle that's off the left.
This is fascinating, I have to say. And again, this is something that we can look to history, not in order to find solutions there, but only to, I think looking to the history is not like, knowing what the end questions would be and what are the answers, but rather it's like looking at past exams. You will not have the same questions in the following exam, but you get a sense of what's coming. So when we look at South Africa and what happened when apartheid collapsed and the new South Africa that was built, and the question of who are the victims of the settlement that was made, that we will have a new democratic, non-racial country, but we will not go as deep as fixing past economic, land-wise atrocities. And that way, in a way, consolidate the class system that apartheid created. Now, I'm not saying that what the ANC has done was wrong. I'm not saying that at all. I look up to them, to what they have done. I'm just saying that this is something that would follow us for many generations, many years, and probably many generations. These things that would have to be eventually agreed. And of course, we will not get everything that we want.
I just want to say, I tend to agree. I just think that if we were to move forward with politics, if at some point a binational agenda, say, or some idea of overcoming the notion of the Jewish democracy will take place, then that will be very quickly the next question. I think the question you're asking is maybe the third question. Maybe it will be wise to ask it earlier. And I tend to be convinced. But the question of, if we're doing politics with Palestinians, we may agree with them on everything, almost, but not on a leftist agenda, not with all of them. And that would be a real political question as opposed to this broader ones.
Only this question comes, I guess, with a pre-question that we touched, but we did not address, which is the fact that there's a consensus now in Israeli politics about the definition of the state as a Jewish state. And that became the prism of democracy. So it comes before democracy in the Israeli politics right now. And I see that as an obstacle to, what we just talked about, because until we resolve that, there's no talking about democracy, without addressing the definition of a Jewish state. I'm sorry, that's my main case.
with, you know, my political journey that I've made took time. I mean, it's very difficult from where there are some consensuses that are all around you. And the notion of Israel as a Jewish democracy and the idea that this is not somehow a conflict of terms is something that, and those who listen to this podcast that are not from Israel and are not acquainted with Israeli day-to-day politics and life would get it hard to realize how deep it is rooted in the Israeli society's ethos. And it goes all the way from the far right to the edges just before the radical left. And I think that has to do with something that is even more profound and more difficult to dismantle. And that is something that is not said, because Jewish democracy is something that is said all the time, where this is a Jewish and democratic state. This is something that is said out loud. But what is not said is that we are maintaining Jewish supremacy. And the question is, and that is the question that precedes the question, I think, of the definition of a state or the identity of the state. How many Jewish citizens of the state of Israel are ready to abandon Jewish supremacy, really abandon it, really peel it off? And I don't think that today there is a significant minority that is really ready. Or you know what? I'm not sure that people understand what it means.
So I'm not sure that I do. So I want to ask you about this because I sort of think that I know what it means, but I'm not sure how exactly you mean it. So in my view, Jewish state cannot be a democracy. That's pretty obvious that this is my view. I'm not sure how this is to be separated from maintaining Jewish supremacy if we're for a moment precisely not speaking about, say, the West Bank. Because there, I think it's pretty clear what Jewish supremacy means in practice. My point is, so to speak, more radical, that the same is true within proper Israel, simply because it is a Jewish state. And because it is a Jewish state that expresses Jewish sovereignty, a claim that I deliberately introduced, I'd like to see whether someone like Michael is going to contest it.
Sorry?
A Jewish sovereignty.
Sovereignty.
Since a Jewish state expresses and preserves Jewish sovereignty, it thereby already entails keeping Jewish supremacy. And so from, I don't see how two can be disentangled. So I don't think that anyone who is still married to the idea of a Jewish state will be willing to give up on Jewish supremacy. But it's possible that I don't think about those terms exactly the same that you do, Michael. And for that reason, I...
Well, I meant the other way around. I meant that changing the identity of the state, stopping calling it a Jewish state, will not cure the main malady, which is Jewish supremacy, and that is ingrained in policy, in practice, in everything, in the structure of government, and in the structure of division of resources.
Yeah.
In a way, because we have, Israel is not the only ethnocracy in the world, but it is probably the only ethnocracy that calls itself an ethnocracy, that says we are a Jewish, we are a state of one nation. And we are also proclaiming that in basic laws. That has not, I'm not sure, maybe I'm wrong, maybe there is, but I think there are many countries that are in practice ethnocracies where one ethnicity holds all the power centers of that.
So I'm not sure which countries you have in mind. It's important for me to say that usually when people try to make the comparisons to European countries, say Germany, Italy, whatever, Denmark, this is completely false, I think. Those are not ethnocracies. So this is not...
These are not the examples I had in mind. More of some of the countries that came out of Yugoslavia, for example,
right,
where you have one ethnicity that holds centers of power. It does not call itself a state of one ethnicity. And yet this is what it is.
Absolutely. This is especially interesting to see what someone like you has to say about this, Mikhail. And then I will shut up with apologies. So my thought would have been that if we manage to reach a situation in which, you know, the notion of the Jewish state has a quasi constitutional significance in Israel. Israel famously does not have a constitution, but this doesn't matter. It does have constitutional power ingrained in even basic laws now and so forth.
It has partial constitution.
If we manage to overcome this, but actually have a constitution that's essentially neutral, that would be one of the main weapons to dismantle the supremacist structures that you describe, because I take it those structures will become unconstitutional. But is that true?
I'm a big believer in constitutional democracy, and of course I believe that a good constitution, a powerful one with a culture of adhering to the constitution may with time heal many of the problems of the past. I do want to say that we have a very complex issue here, because while on the one hand we think that the state of Israel should become a state of all of its citizens, I think that at the same time, it can also be a homeland for the Jewish people. And the question is how you do the one without the other, or with the other, sorry, rather. And it's a very mighty task, because the state of Israel should be a state and could be a state which allows its both nations to feel that they're not only citizens of that state, but also that's how they profess their nationality. And since we're not starting from zero, but from a very imbalanced point, very asymmetrical point, the process towards that is extremely difficult.
I just want to agree, but yeah, I'll shut up now.
No, but that brings me to another point, which makes it even harder. It's like challenges are just piling up. So what we have now, basically, is that Meretz and HaAvoda, as the left parties or so-called left, they surely define themselves as ones. What we have now is a big consensus in the Jewish-Israeli politics about how Israel should be defined, about the territories. And basically, there's a kind of like a surrender of left narrative to somewhat a nationalist, maybe also religious consensus that was never as, I don't know, major in Israel as it is now. I remember a different Israel. I remember Israel that it was possible to dream of one day becoming a democracy. I was able to dream of, I even got a prize for an essay about living together, Jews and Arabs in Israel. I was only 10 when I wrote it, and there was this hope that something, that nothing is okay, but something will change and for the better, because there were like, I don't know, islands of core values of left that felt as if they were there. Maybe it was, you know, a wrong notion. And I don't see it today. I see left that is more right than left. I see politics that go in a certain direction, and as if there's, you know, nothing comes from what was supposed to be left, and it's the void is even bigger today than it was ever before. That was
I see this differently a little bit. I think that the dream that you describe, and I think that Mikhail was describing the same dream, and I certainly know it myself too. I think it was an illusion, and I think that because. Correct me if I don't understand your dream, but the dream was of a better Jewish democracy.
I don't know. It was about equality.
in a Jewish democracy, in the Jewish democracy.
Well,
I'm not, I don't want to describe probably. Your dream. Maybe,
no,
maybe
you're right. I guess it was. One.
But the notion was, we have a left that, you know, we have those parties, let's say, at least Meretz. Nobody where I come from thought that Avodah, that Labor would do it. But at least Meretz, the dream was that we can overcome the occupation. We can have, if Meretz will never be the government, it will not be the ruling party, so then we can do, I can only say this in Hebrew, how did Yossi Sarid say? Yumratz Rabin. Yeah, we can make Rabin like Meretz. And if we do that, and we do this successfully enough, and actually have a Palestinian state, und so weiter und so fort, then that was the hope. And I really do think that this was not a dream, but an illusion. And that the indication, it's not a proof for the illusion, is what Meretz is doing now. I think that if we agree that the maintenance of Jewish supremacy is also tied to the ideology of a Zionist left, then I think that Meretz was pretty much always in the end there. It was willing to make some different compromises than a lot of people among the Labour Party and definitely the center and the right. But it was in the end, in my knowledge of those people, always there. And for that reason, I cannot say I'm disappointed, but I'm not surprised that in the end, this party chose the consensus with settlers and is being able to do that. I'm sure that they feel uncomfortable doing it. I'm sure that they would have preferred to keep their illusion and some people's dreams while doing it, and that they're uncomfortable because these illusions now blow up. But they're still doing that. And I think that they need to overcome their own principles before they can dream a better dream. So I in that sense, I don't think that I grew up with a different dream from yours. But I do not think that the problem is that at some point we could imagine something that now we cannot imagine. Rather, a certain bubble just blew up. And
did it really blow up? Because basically we're maintaining a bubble that might have already blown up, but you can still see it, just like, you know, stars that died a long time ago and you can still see in the stars. We're holding on to this bubble that maybe was bursted some way or another, but we still maintain it. So it really doesn't matter if there is a bubble or not, as long as we believe there's a bubble, if you understand what I'm saying.
Not sure. One way, and I'm always humble to say this next to Michael, but because speaking about the rule of law and issues like that, what do I know about that? But here's for me, one example of that is the rule of law. Meretz entered this coalition in order to save Israeli rule of law. If you really believe there is such a thing as a rule of law and that you will go and preserve the rule of law with Ayelet Shaked, Gideon Saar, and Naftali Bennett, and Avigdor Lieberman, I forgot, didn't want to leave out anybody. If you believe that you can rescue Israeli rule of law with those people, then obviously something in your dream is very wrong. And I believe that people in Meretz actually believe that in a deep way, right? Because they believe in the Jewish democracy.
Okay, I depart from you here, because not because I think that the dream was not an illusion, but because I think that it was clear that the part of it that was not an illusion, the part of it which said we want to end the occupation and we want to have some kind of an agreement with the Palestinians, we all knew deep inside that we don't know where that would lead in the identity of our country. And in that respect, the so-called change government is a declaration by Meretz that the end of occupation is not prioritized as other things for which they entered the government. So that process that would start with a peace process with the Palestinians, seemingly only dealing with the occupied, those territories that were occupied in 1967, but rocks the boat. Whatever the outcome will be, it will rock the boat. Israel without the occupation is not Israel without the occupation, minus the occupation. It will be something else. And now we have the left-wing or so-called left-wing parties saying, well, there are much more important things than that. In the 80s, they would never have said that was the main issue. That was the existential dilemma that we need to solve. And so, you know, it's like when you go into the government with settlers, as you say, you're making a statement. You're saying this is not important. There's something else that is more, much more important. And in that respect, your despair, Karen, is understandable. Not because the vision of Meretz was one that was great, but because the process that it supported was one that had many promises in it.
But I do not completely agree. Sorry, go ahead, Karen.
I was just thinking, maybe it's because, and maybe it's because I was younger, it felt that there is a voice that cries out for human rights for all the people in the territory, no matter that it doesn't really matter that it didn't exist, okay? But that was the notion. And I think the notion today is that Palestinians' human rights are negotiable. It's okay. It's okay as long as we maintain an illusion of solution. That this is possible, that, you know, equality and human rights will get there, but it became a consensus that it's okay that it's not now. You know what I mean? It's a pressing issue, and I think the Israeli politics is all about, you know, just laying it low and not avoiding the issues, and the international arena is also, you know, taking the cue from Israel. And it seems like it's okay. So the Palestinians would wait. But the thing about human rights is that you can't wait.
No, but it's worse than that, Karen, because the deal was not we'll wait. If it was stop, freeze, we'll be back to you in 4 years, that would have been better than what we do have. The deal is, we're not stopping anything. We'll continue at the same pace. That's the status quo. We'll continue the same pace. And mind you, the pace that we're inheriting is from the most radical right-wing government Israel has ever had in the left-right meaning that Israel is ascribed to it. One that pushed constantly for expansion of settlements, confiscation of lands, backing the most violent sectors among the settler community. So we're continuing that. And in a way, it's like looking at, you know, at climate change and saying, let's wait. Let's continue in the same pace, not accelerate it, not diminish the pace of pollution, but just keep on in the same pace. What will happen?
I want to join that, but still by taking a little step backward and then connecting to that. I still disagree with you, Michael, about this analysis of Meretz. Not because I think I'll allow myself to say that I'm slightly younger than you two. And this is significant because I was of a different age just in the middle of Oslo. And I think that you experienced it as slightly more grown up. I was, you know, 13, 14.
No, I was more grown up than you.
I remember the hope, but I also remember the conversations at home. I had a political house and a very strong Meretz, left Meretz even, I would say. And I have a different perception of what was going on. You said, and I think that in some sense you're right, and I think we need to hold on to the way in which you're right, because we have to be optimistic. We do. It's a duty. However, I agree that the end game was never clear, among other things, because Oslo never offered a state to the Palestinians. So the way there's a way to look at this, this is a bad thing. And a lot of my friends on the left do exactly that. I also now in my book try to actually precisely agree with you, I suppose, and say it's also a good thing. It could, the end game could have been different. And there are other expressions of that. I think we all understand what we're talking about. Yeah. However, I think that Meretz and those leftists, including on the left margins of Meretz, were always also committed to the two-state solution because they wanted to preserve precisely the structure of the Jewish state and the structure of Jewish supremacy. The people that I know from home, my neighbors, where I grew up in that place in the Galilee where, you know, one of those villages that were built in order to Judaize the Galilee. Back then, people were voting Meretz more than to Labor and Likud together.
Wow.
Still, we agree, you said it before, and you highlighted this more than I did, but we agree. This is a participation in the structure of supremacy. And those were the people. Those were the people who wanted the two-state solution. We know this language. Because you want to preserve the Jewish state.
Yeah.
And my feeling is that what we're seeing now is precisely the resolution of that logic. So that nothing fundamentally has changed. Those people wanted a two-state solution to preserve the Jewish state. And they now discover that they can do the same. Preserve their Jewish democracy. That's also why I'm so concerned, precisely now taking the step forward to the conversation that I just interrupted, with this acceleration. You didn't say acceleration, even though I wonder what you know and think about that. There's a sense, not just that we're maintaining a status quo that was as bad as any time, but actually that it's even worse than that.
Well, that I can say, as someone that follows closely, that there are very alarming evidence that it's not just status quo, but actually acceleration. It is, you know, we all come from social studies and statistics is not my major. And you can present the figures in different ways. What is definite is that this government in the last, that took power 6 months ago, has advanced some plans that while in figures might not be more than in the past, but in matter of how crucial, important, strategic the locations are, past governments have not dared to do. So yes, definitely, there are some alarming evidence that things go even worse than in the past government.
So basically, maybe it's time for, you know, drastic measures.
Revolution.
Let's start with, you know, declaring the death of the Israeli left and creating a new one out of the ashes, the new phoenix of the left.
How many movements have called themselves the new left?
That's exactly the point. And as you can see, most of them are becoming, you know, more and more, you know, to the right of the center, not even right of the left. And it's scary. But then again, this is exactly why I was thinking about raising, you know, the voice of left. And we still haven't even talked about the feasibility of what is, you know, the solution that the so-called left is offering today to the situation. You know, we did not even talk about what other solutions are there except of this, the two-state solution. So there is still a lot to be desired.
Yeah, but I think our role at this stage, when the world is still coping with right-wing populism and huge blows to liberal democracy, our role is to prepare the ground and the ideological ground for the change when it will come, because we cannot anticipate how it will come. We have to take as a given that at a certain point all the stars will align and change will come. And then the question is, are we ready for that moment, or are we missing that moment and we'll have to wait few more rounds until again that will be possible. And that's why I think the podcast, your podcast, is so important, and writings like Omri's books and the work, the setting the ground for new ideas and holistic ideas, ones that cover full ground of values, is so important at this stage. We cannot just listen to the last news bulletin and decide, so how do we go from here? That's not a good, I think, strategy.
Never is.
And I think that it's important to see that it's important that this is being done also internationally. I think that this needs to be done in Israel. Maybe the main thing, I speak from outside of Israel now, obviously, but the one thing that is extremely important, I'm not sure how much of it is happening, is preparing the ability of actual collaboration of Jews and Palestinians, the infrastructure of that thing. If not a political party, the joint list is not yet doing that. It doesn't have this language and it doesn't have this structure because it's a political, it's a party or a list, and it has its own power structures, and it's not one in which Jews and Palestinians collaborate naturally. Will we have the infrastructure for such emerging collaborations? That's one thing that I think is extremely important. I'm not sure is there.
And
internationally, maybe slightly more. Internationally, maybe slightly more in some corners of the universe. Maybe some political actors, some even powers, some government, some foundations that will be at least able to pick up certain ideas and support them, provide them legitimacy, money. I'm not sure.
Yeah. But just, I want, you know, for the sake of raising the spirits a little, I want to say, if we would hold this podcast recording a year ago, a year and a half ago, and I would talk about apartheid as something that has relevancy to the Israeli regime, wherever it is, that would be something that some Palestinians are talking about, many Palestinians are talking about, but no one listens to them. Right. And some very fringe, radical, left-wing activists. And look what happened in the last year and a half. Several major civil society, international civil society, and Israeli civil society organizations have come out with the notion that Israel is committing the crime of apartheid in the West Bank. That's a report that I wrote for Yesh Din, that Israel regime as a whole is an apartheid regime, B'Tselem, and the Human Rights Watch report. And recently, last week, I read that Foreign Minister Lapid has cautioned in a briefing that he gave, I think, journalists, that he forecasts that in the next year or so, at least one international organization, UN body, will charge Israel with the commission of the crime of apartheid. So, you know, while things are not looking good in the lens of Israeli politics and how it treats the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, there are some things that are moving and changing. And we have the International Criminal Court's investigation. There is a whole thing is going on around that thing. And it is difficult to say when and how it will, you know, converge into some huge change. And again, I'm saying, and we have to be ready for it with the plan.
I agree.
This is just too optimistic for me. I got to tell you, I want to agree. So that I'll agree to want to agree.
Yeah. Do we have a moment for the other? I mean, this is a recurring theme in Michael's writing, the optimism. One day it will happen and we have to be ready for it. There is also the opposite. There is also the other side. And the other side is maybe not less likely, maybe more likely, especially because Meretz is in coalition, drawing no red lines. And this is the possibility that the situation will be resolved by a second Nakba or issues of the sort. And that the stars, the constellation will be perfect with a big war, with I'm not sure in which constellation, that will allow the resolution of the fact that apartheid is unsustainable. A Jewish minority cannot preserve not just a Jewish democracy, but cannot preserve a state controlling a majority of Palestinians. And for that reason, there will have to be a resolution, either the optimistic one in which apartheid will fall, and we have to be ready for it. The question is also the readiness of us and the readiness of the international community to a moment in which more horrifying crimes ensue, and also enable a resolution, quote unquote, resolution of this unstable situation. That's the other side, which I'm not always sure that Michael is, when you speak about the occupation will end, apartheid will end, can also end this way.
Yeah.
Plus, it's no, also, if I may add, it also puts the Israeli people in a very passive position, which I'm not sure is right, especially since you always have to, I would use the word zeitgeist, but you know, you have to understand the, I would say, environment in which mm-hmm. Israelis are now facing would be a good word.
Operating.
Yeah. And that is something that you have to put in consideration. The fact that we called it just now Jewish supremacy, sorry, it's more than a notion. It's becoming a modus operandi in Israel, and it's becoming a form of thought, and you know, waiting for an alignment of stars that would change doesn't take in account the fact that, you know, there are people here and the way they think must and should be changed before this alignment, and this voice is not heard enough.
Okay, so you're both good friends of mine, but you're both misrepresenting the type of optimism that I do represent. First of all, in all the places where I talk about and write about the alignment of stars, I constantly say that we need to bring the day, yeah, from the Israel, from the known Jewish song. It's not enough to sit and wait for it. We have to bring it. And I also am very aware that the positive scenario is not definite. And even when I wrote what became almost a signature of my writings, an op-ed saying that one day the occupation will end, the exact words were that I do not know how much bloodshed will be spilled before that happens, and whether it will be peaceful or as an outcome of a tragedy. So it is clear to me that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict may end in a tragedy. But as for the scenario of a second Nakba, or let's put it in the right terms, a genocide, while I'm not ruling that completely out, I think in order for that to be a possibility, the world has to very, very significantly change. Very, very significantly. Now, with climate change and with wars around the world, many things may happen. I'm not saying that I'm completely ruling this out. But the idea that in this region, a genocide can take place without the world stopping it, intervening, is very, very far-fetched for me, unless the world will be a completely different world than it is today. And the reasons for, there are many reasons for that. Not all of them are very flattering to the international community. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict has been a centerpiece of political action in a way that is completely unproportional to other conflicts and how much political capital they have received in the world. People have been killed and died in wars and endless conflicts without the world laying a hand, without the international community trying to solve it, while Israel-Palestine is, since for 100 years, is being, and especially since 1947, is the most talked about, dealt with conflict in the world. So, and there are other reasons why I can't think of this. Also, at the end of the day, I don't think that Israel and the Israeli society has it in it so much viciousness as to embark on a genocidal project. I don't think so.
I so hope you're right. Well, Michael, I find it hard to continue after this optimistic note, which I find wonderful. I don't know where you find the energy.
No, I call it rational optimism. It's not a belief. It's not. I'm not saying that I'm certain. I'm just saying there is an optimist route, and it makes sense that it might happen. And now it's for us to make it happen, to put the effort in order to do it.
I think that I agree with Michael on this. I'm not sure that I completely agree about. I'm more worried about the genocidal options, actually. However, I do agree that it doesn't even matter so much. The optimism is a duty. The only thing that we can do is to believe that that change is possible and to do what we can in order to bring it about. So for that reason, I don't think that there is a substantial, that there is any disagreement about the content of the optimism.
Right, it's just that the reality is very grim.
Don't listen to the last news bulletin. Think past that.
I never do, by the way. I try not to hear them at all, which is quite funny. Well, you know, when you think that that's what I do, I write politics, but I really try not to listen to radio and television and get my sources from elsewhere because it's kind of depressing. In any case, I want to thank you guys for a wonderful conversation that I think deserves more, especially if this optimism, Michael, rubs on others. I need that. And we will say our goodbyes. If there are any final sentences like that you would like to conclude with.
Thank you very much for hosting us and for bringing us together.
Yeah, it's great. It's anytime. Great to talk to you and to see you both again. So.
Here too. So thank you and hope to see you soon again.
Bye-bye.
Bye.